Woke up this morning, happy as could be. Looked out my window, and what did I see? I'm coming up my sidewalk, just as plain as day. Well, here come trouble that I never thought I'd see when you went away. Hello, trouble. Come on.
Well, I began my investigation of the Black Dahlia in 2013. It wasn't until 2016 that I first made it to Los Angeles to conduct in-person interviews and visit the locations. I subsequently lived in LA off and on for the better part of 4 years, always working on other projects, but also never not working on the Dahlia case. Now, here, 6 years later, the final product is out as a series on Audible, and I'm relatively pleased with how it turned out in the end, but I would be lying if I didn't admit that this was one of the most difficult, trying, and outright exhausting experiences of my life. 8 years of my life, by the way. And given that I'm currently 39 years old, it's roughly 20% of my life in sum. So, 1/5 of my life has carried with it the stress of this project. But it's probably not what you're thinking. Yes, the actual investigation of solving the Black Dahlia was difficult. But the business side of selling the Black Dahlia was outright hell. A lot of folks like to talk shit about LAX Airport, but if you've flown through it as much as I have, in my opinion, it's one of the easiest to navigate in the nation, especially when compared to good old LaGuardia. Holy hell. Even saying the name is giving me anxiety right now. Sorry if you work there, and I'm especially sorry if you have to fly in and out of there on a regular basis. But that is the worst airport in the United States. And that's exactly where I'm headed. Straight from LA, with Mr. Bubbins in one hand, and a 27-inch iMac in the other. I have to be in New York to begin editing the TV show I did, and the network is putting me and Bubs up in an apartment directly across the street from One World Trade Center. Side note, if you do know my father, ask him about it. He's got pictures on his iPhone of Freedom Tower that he's pretty proud of. I work at an office on Wall Street 7 days a week, and while it's a lot of work, I'm still working on the Dahlia. The investigation, as far as I thought at the time, was done, and so now I'm on my hustle to sell it. I sent out a lot of emails to both TV and podcast production companies while in New York, and my agent was contacting them on my behalf as well. One day I get an email from my agent informing me that a particular podcast production company was interested in my Dahlia project, and that she had set up a meeting the following day for me to meet them at their offices in Midtown. And so, the next day at 2 p.m., I go uptown to meet this company, which, from here on out, I'm going to refer to as Duplicity. So I arrive at the Duplicity offices, and I'm escorted to the main meeting room, where two gentlemen in their late 30s are waiting with notepads. I begin to describe my project, and after 5 minutes, they stop me and bring in two more people. And by the time I'm done, there are 6 Duplicity employees sitting around the table taking furious notes. My thinking is this. Excellent. These guys love it so much, they can't stop taking notes. Baby, we are in like Flint. If you've never heard that phrase before or get that reference, well then, myself and James Coburn just feel terribly sorry for you.
There's only one man to cope with it. Find Derek Flint.
Flint. Flint. Flint. You're in Moscow with him.
Derek, darling, what are you doing in Moscow?
For the next 3 months, we dance around, back and forth, on terms of a contract, until I start to get annoyed, because A, I did around 200 contracts with the Department of Defense when I was a contractor, and I know that when they are a priority, even those which require a top secret clearance can get done in about a week. And B, duplicity has gone radio silent on me and will only communicate with my agent now. And so, I inform my agent that they now have a deadline of Friday at close of business, and if they don't make it, they don't get the project, and I'm taking it elsewhere. Friday comes, 5 p.m. comes, which is standard close of business. I'm standing in front of the W Hotel, staring at my phone. 5:01. I open my email and I send a message to my agent. Cancel the deal. They're amateurs. I then head upstairs for happy hour with my dear friend Ben Smith. It's now Monday. I call my agent, and she tells me that she informed them the deal is canceled, but hasn't heard back from Duplicity. Fine. Fuck 'em, I say. Let's move on to the next one. The summer moves into fall, and in September my lease is ending in New York, so I get the wise idea to move down to Key West for the winter. Roughly a week after Hurricane Irma packed up and left. Probably not my best decision ever, but I did get a better deal on my Airbnb, so, you know, like, shut up about it. I speak with about a dozen production companies while I'm in the Keys, and while they all talk a big game, nothing materialized. And now, here's another side note, and one that was told to me when I first came to Hollywood but didn't believe. I'll share it with you in hopes you'll believe me. But if not, well, don't say dear old Doug didn't warn you. In Hollywood, yes means no. And no means maybe. And maybe means depends on what you're willing to do for it. So now you understand when I say that I was getting a lot of yes absolutelys, which I should have translated at the time into a pile of no fucking ways. The other problem with getting a yes means you can't take your project to another production company and keep shopping it around. The production company that said yes will lock you down with a shopping agreement, which can run anywhere from 90 days to 2 years. Obviously, I won't sign one over 90 days, so every 3 months, here I am, back at the drawing board. I do a lot of traveling during 2018 and think I've sold the Dahlia once as a TV show, and then again once as a podcast. But nope. After 90 days, nothing. And if I may, please allow me to dispel another myth here. For me, actually selling the Dahlia Project for the money is not the point. Getting it published is. Because podcast money is paltry, and the TV money only comes in when they make you a producer, which no one was willing to do with me. Please understand when I say, selling this project as a TV show is about the monetary equivalent of selling a mid-range car. Selling it as a podcast is the equivalent of selling an old pickup truck. And just so we're clear, why I didn't even attempt to turn this into a book. That payout would have been the monetary equivalent of a nice steak dinner by yourself, with no more than 2 glasses of wine. February of 2019, and I'm back in Ohio writing proposals with my dear friend Ben Smith to pitch to production companies who might be looking for, well, two handsome devils to cast for their next project. One morning, I get a text message from Ben with a link to a podcast. I read the title of the podcast, and then I notice that, look at that. It's published by those idiots at Duplicity. How about that? I mention this to Ben, who responds, "Yeah, dude, I'm pretty sure they stole your project." "Impossible," I say, and then I play the podcast. Now, anyone who knows me realizes that I have the longest wick on the planet, and it takes forever to burn through. However, it's also attached to the biggest stick of dynamite in the Western Hemisphere. And there are really only two things that will set it off: hurt someone I love or betray me. I spend the rest of the day intensely researching this copycat project and listen to each episode. My parents stop by to drop off some cat litter they saw on sale at Menards. After a few moments of discussion, they recognize the Terminator look in my eyes and leave quietly.
I need your clothes, your boots, and your motorcycle. Forgot to say please.
After I consume, actually no, devour everything on this project, I call my agent. No answer. So I send an email without any words. I simply forward the same link that Ben Smith sent me earlier that morning. Around 9:30 p.m., presumably after my agent had drank up the courage to respond, I receive a one-sentence email back. "Yeah, I wasn't thrilled about that." "Yeah, I wasn't thrilled about that." "Yeah, I wasn't thrilled about that." Realizing you have no recourse is a tough pill to swallow. I couldn't sue because they missed the deadline and never signed the contract with me, remember? And while I could put Duplicity on blast right here and right now by saying their company name and the name of the podcast, I won't, because I don't want sued for defamation. And out of sheer self-preservation, I'll say, you know, even if you guys didn't steal my podcast and then straight up ghost me, that's sure how it felt to me. And perception is reality. And oh yeah, one more thing. Fuck you. Over the course of the summer, I haven't heard from my agent since her laconic last email, which is fine, as I have independently signed yet another shopping agreement with a small company out of Santa Barbara that wants to turn the Dolly into a TV series. They absolutely suck. It's a husband and wife team, and they too are largely unresponsive. I remind them that our shopping agreement is coming to an end soon, and I get a really nasty email back from the husband that ends with, "Capiche?" to the next one. In the fall of 2019, I start substituting in Ohio until COVID takes over, and then retreat back to my cave. As anyone from Ohio knows, the winter will last until roughly May, with a handful of 75 degree days mixed in, only to be followed by 4 below 0 the very next day. I love the Buckeye State. Sometime starting in 2020, I'm notified that a group of Dahlia enthusiasts, all of whom I know, are starting a weekly Zoom session to discuss all things Dahlia. I, of course, join, and this proves to be immensely helpful with hammering out the kinks in my already existing Dahlia project. And in many ways, I'm glad that I haven't sold it yet, because I'm refining it after each weekly Zoom session. Now, since this is all about the business side of selling my podcast, I have to skip ahead 18 months because little happened during that time frame related to the project, as Hollywood all but shut down during COVID. So now, here we are in the spring of 2021, and a young producer who once passed on my Dahlia project as a TV show sends me an email requesting me to be a guest on a podcast he now produces. I agree, do the podcast, and then afterward, while he and I are speaking on the phone, ask him if he would like to consider the Dahlia again, but now as a podcast. We talk. He introduces me to some people at his new company, and lo and behold, drumroll please, I get another shopping agreement. But this time, miraculously, this guy, let's just call him James, because that's his name, actually sells the project during the 90-day window to Audible. I cannot believe it. Now, at this point, because I own all of the content, which is referred to as intellectual property, James' company has to buy that from me in order to use it in the podcast they've just sold to Audible. So we go back and forth over the summer and finally get a suitable contract sorted out, and now I'm on the hook for a few things. Because I'm the one who knows the most about the crime, and it was my idea in the first place, I'm tasked with writing 6 episodes with an arc that leads the listener from beginning to end, that is highly entertaining, but also suspenseful. Pretty easy, right? What you're currently listening to, these words I am speaking right now, I wrote. The words I'm currently speaking are being read into a microphone and recorded. And then I sit down and do all of the editing, add all of the music and sound effects, and listen to it about 1,000 times before uploading it. No one tells me what to write or to change anything. So if you hate what you're hearing, you have only me to blame. However, when you're writing for others, and they are paying you to do so, they want it written their way. And it is a spinning kick to the face on a Van Damme daily basis. Hope you see what I did there. Take this for example. I write, "The cat ran to the store." I get a message back. "How about the cat trotted to the store?" Okay, cool, got it. Trotted to the store. another message. Can we identify the store, please? Like, what type of store is this? Well, what do you want it to be? I don't know, you're the author. And it goes on like this until you complete the project or you find the nearest bridge. So, once you get it blessed, and they confirm that the writing is done, and they are satisfied with your trotting cats, you're on the hook for recording it in a studio. Now realize this. What you are hearing right now, my voice, this was recorded in my home. Granted, I do have some nice equipment, but I am right this very second speaking these words into my microphone while sitting in my house wearing a Buffalo Bills hoodie, thanks Mom, running pants, and flip-flops. I take breaks to sedate Mr. Bubbins with tuna, and then I eat some of my Subway sandwich. Knowing all of that, this sounds half-assed decent on your end, doesn't it? So, I argue this point with my producer, stating that I can do all of the recordings from my home. Nope. We're doing it in a studio in Los Angeles. See you there. As it happens, I'm moving to LA for alternate reasons anyway, so I really don't mind. And I've done lots of studio voiceover for the television stuff I've done in the past, so it doesn't bother me that much. Until I come to the realization that this was much different than TV voiceover, where they just say, "Hey Doug, say this sentence 3 times in a row, and we're gonna take the best one, thanks." Not so with podcasting. It was the same as the writing process, only now we are making corrections live, and I have to keep repeating a line until they are satisfied with how it sounds. I don't know how I sound to you currently, but I'm a fairly low-key guy, so I cannot tell you how many times I am told to bring up the energy. Needless to say, this gets taxing after a while, and for those who know me, I can be difficult to deal with when I don't like something, and I'll start to create distance, which is not so much what a producer wants you to do when they need you in a studio and you don't show up for a few days. But that's me. And yet, at the same time, I'm a professional, so I hang in there until the project is fully recorded. After that, I never saw it again until the day it published.
I want the people of America to be able to work less for the government and more for themselves. I want them to have the rewards of their own industry. This is the chief meaning of freedom. Until we can reestablish a condition under which the earnings of the people can be kept by the people, we are bound to suffer a very severe and distinct curtailment of our liberty.
For 5 years, I had a poster on the wall of my office staring straight at me with a quote from President Calvin Coolidge. "Nothing in this world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent." If you believe Cool Cow's advice, then being thought of as a broken record isn't always a bad thing. Sometimes, sure. But a lot of times, if you really want something to happen, you're going to have to keep at it relentlessly until it does. Yes, I am aware of the saying about doing the same thing over and over again with the same results is the definition of insanity. Sure, but again, in certain circumstances. Because consider, with this project, I did the same thing over and over and over and over and over again with the same results and still kept going. Was I insane? Ultimately, the results did change. I've read quite a few books on Michelangelo and take solace in the fact that a lot of people thought he was insane, and Pope Julius routinely screwed him over on money and contracts. He also critiqued the shit out of Michelangelo's work and could be counted on to always make the situation more difficult. Sometimes the stone couldn't be delivered from the quarry. Other times it would get delivered, but Michelangelo couldn't afford to have it moved to his workshop. And on occasion, his commissions would be given to other artists like Leonardo or Raphael. It took me 8 years to take the Dahlia project from conception to final product. Michelangelo sculpted the 17-foot David out of marble in 4 years. I think it's high time for me to buy a new chisel.
Wasn't.